Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Hail! Spot flooding. What? They ruin everything, don't they? They have to ruin everything. Just when we were all thinking, yes, sun is out, this is who we really are. We're a carefree Mediterranean people. We'll be hunched up again and in the dark out of the rain again, like proper Irish people. Okay, let's have a look at the papers. The Business Post are now saying up to 80,000 new homes a year are needed between now and 2050. This is from the Housing Commission. Now, there's differing opinions in the Housing Commission and there's different models. So if population growth reaches 7.25 million and household size drops below two people per home, Ireland could need more than 80,000 houses a year. And you see, we tend to think, well, that'll never happen. Like, but all these things that we thought were never going to happen then happen. So that's that. Sunday Independent, migrant welfare reviews as Harris vows to get, quotes, firm. Philip Ryan writing a major review of welfare supports and housing entitlements offered to asylum seekers, along with a crackdown is the word, on illegal employment is being looked at. The Sunday Times, critical risks in public health warns top medic, and Hugh O'Connell writing there that the state's chief medical officer privately warned the government her office was critically fragile and functioning at high risk 3 months before she resigned. And remember, we were all, the public health was going to be the thing and we were getting ready for the next pandemic and everything else. So the chief medical officer has resigned. Two of the four deputy chief medical officer posts have been vacant for more than a year, with the Department of Health running two separate and unsuccessful recruitment processes. But again, I think it seems that public health doctors can make more money working as actual public health doctors. The Irish Mail on Sunday, RTE invoices, quotes, lost in move worth 400,000. So yeah, RTE could not produce invoices for 400,000 of transactions, including, it says here, invoices relating to a trip to the Japanese rugby, to the World Cup, a junket they call it. And the Sunday World, Kinahan linked to Josh hit rifle. So fierce street gang involved in fatal Wild West shooting sourced AR-15 semi-automatic weapon from senior cartel associates. And this is again around the killing of Josh Itzeli. And it was kind of scary stuff that there's these teenagers running around with serious weaponry. The Sun is leading with the footballer Anthony Stokes being released from prison, and the Mirror, Bambi's Euro heartache, Ireland's best result in 24 years despite day of drama and controversy. Now, our panel today, Alison O'Connor is a columnist with the Sunday Times. Aideen Hayden is a housing policy expert and former chair of Threshold. Michael O'Flynn is chairman and CEO of the O'Flynn Group and a member of the Housing Commission. And Professor Alan Barrett is the CEO of the ESRI. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Brendan.
Morning.
Alison, did you watch your fellow county person in the Eurovision?
I did, Brendan, and what a weekend for Cork. That was just after Cork had beaten Limerick. So all around positivity. I watched it. The junior members of the household, of my household, are very big Eurovision fans. And I was reflecting during the week after the semi-finals of the sort of feel, how feel good it was and how lovely that was and how much we needed that bounce. But that was kind of, I don't know, dampened a bit by last night, just given the way the politics sort of took over the pop. And how the conflict between what's happening in Palestine, Israel. And I felt it made me sad, even for my two teenagers, the way that, I mean, the Eurovision is meant to be all about fun and madness. And I thought Bambi Thug, it was a magnificent, magnificent performance. And it was a wonderful production on the part of Sweden. But just very distressing, I think, given the way we have, you know, our feelings in this country about what's happening in Gaza. I mean, even with the vote, the public vote on Tuesday night, and then last night, Israel doing so well, they came fifth. You just sort of wonder
Israel
how...
Israel got 10 points from Ireland.
She said, I actually didn't. I don't know whether.
No, he was getting laid at this stage.
Yeah, no, it was. For me, too. I didn't know.
But they certainly got a huge number of funds in the public.
What was interesting was trying to work out, like, you think, are we so utterly out of step with the rest of Europe? But someone else in my sitting room put forward the theory, is it that people who feel so strongly about it, who are anti what Israel are doing, did they all completely disengage from the Eurovision and not vote? I mean, I don't know enough about how the system works, and that therefore people who were maybe wanted Israel to do well were much more engaged and much more motivated. Was that the point? And I mean, there's a lot of coverage in the papers. Obviously, they didn't. I think is it only the Mirror that went to press afterwards that got it. You know, on the whole, and what I suppose a stressful week it was, even for the people that were covering it. Patrick O'Donoghue, who was there for the Sunday Times, and he goes into a lot of detail about this row, the rising tension yesterday, and even the people wondering would Bambi Thug actually perform. So there's a lot of detail there. So I suppose the bottom line is we came sixth. That was our best performance in nearly a quarter of a century. But just an awful pity that that it was surrounded by everything it
by
was.
Drama. Yeah,
by the drama. And yet there's reason, there's very valid reason for why it was.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way you'd wonder, Aideen, was it an interesting kind of aspect to this, that if you're having this internationalist kind of thing, that this conversation has to come up?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, I would have said earlier in the entire process that I was in favour of us boycotting, to be quite honest. Ireland has a... You know, we actually invented the term boycott, and it's a very valid way of showing protest in a way that is, you know, speaking with your feet more than anything else, I guess. But that's what Bambi Thug decided. They decided to participate, and I went along with it, and I watched it in good heart from beginning to end last night. I got to say my Eurodar is not that sharp, because I didn't see Switzerland coming. And but the one thing that did occur to me was the 300 extra points from the public vote that Israel got. And I'm wondering, on top of a couple of other things that have happened this week, for the sake of argument, one of the benefactors of Trinity College removing funding on the basis that they're saying that Jewish students don't feel welcome in Trinity. And then on top of that, a number of people being interviewed on various radio programmes during the week saying that they're feeling uncomfortable. And they're feeling that what's happening,
Jewish people,
yeah, that what's happening in, you know, between Israel and what's happening in Gaza is making them feel that they are not wanted in certain communities. And that gave me some pause for thought, because I would not like my opinion in relation to Israel's actions in Gaza to imply in any way that I have any negativity towards the Jewish people. And I do think that public
and look, I don't meet too many Jewish people, but the ones I do meet, do you not find that they would probably tend to agree with you about Netanyahu and about what's going on?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. I mean, I did find, funnily enough, a number of years ago at a housing conference, totally unprovoked, a housing expert from a professor from a US university came up to me totally randomly and attacked me for Ireland's position in relation to Palestine. Like, this is at a casual drinks reception. I was really stunned. Like, I really was. But I'm very surprised. But obviously, within certain branches of, you know, Israeli society, Ireland's position is well known, and our support for Palestine is well known. And it is regarded as an affront to Israel by a number of people. But I think in general, we need to be very careful in not associating all members of the Jewish community with our disapproval of what Israel is doing in Palestine. And I do think the public vote there.
Do you think
last
there was
night,
a certain sympathy for that young woman? A 20-year-old young woman?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, no, I do. Yeah.
Do you think that might have been part of it, that there was some kind of a backlash against where people thought, well, hang on, she's not waging war in Gaza, and she's here in very difficult circumstances, being booed and everything.
I think there's an element of that as well. But at the end of the day, I think it brings across what Alison's saying, that, you know, we all want this to be a song contest. in essence, I think when it was decided that Russia would be banned over its actions in Ukraine, that made it a bit more political than it had been in the past. And I would have liked to have seen a similar response in relation to Israel's actions in Gaza. That didn't happen. It went ahead. Fair enough. It was done in good spirit. And, you know, let's just move on from it. But for me, there was a bit of a lesson there in terms of we need to be a bit more careful how our language is impacting on, you know, others who do not share necessarily, other Jewish people who don't share their sympathies for what's happening in Gaza.
Okay, so back to a bit of more local reality now. Michael O'Flynn, you chose a piece in the Business Post. There's a good bit around housing today, some of it involving yourself, outspoken developer Michael O'Flynn, as you referred to. But will we start with no shortage of builders, claims Cairn Homes chief. That's their CEO, Michael Stanley. He's in the Business Post saying there's no shortage of builders. Is that true?
I think it is true. And I think it's been put up there as one of the reasons why we can't deliver more housing. I think that's incorrect. We have proven in the past that we can deliver more housing than was needed. We certainly have capacity to deliver a lot more than what is currently being delivered.
So are there men and women at the moment who could be working building houses who are not?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, the answer is yes. And an independent report done recently by Turner Townsend, who are consultants, looked at this and they said that the industry had at least 20% more capacity. I would say because of the change in office requirement and because of the whole commercial impact at this time, that a lot of the people that would have been employed in that sector could be employed in building housing. Wouldn't be a huge ask. And to answer your question,
pure manpower, how many could we build a year? Just on manpower, if we take out the other limits.
And you'll appreciate I won't be going to anything connected to the commission.
Yeah.
More than 50,000 a year would not be an issue at this moment in time.
And again, we'll come to the other things of financing and planning and all that.
Of course.
Could the industry pivot into building 50,000?
Plus
residential now, like.
Absolutely.
We want that next year, it could go.
Total confidence from speaking with colleagues from my own structure and from discussing it in detail. We have the capacity to build 50,000 plus all day long at this moment in time.
Alan, you picked that piece as well.
Yeah, I think Michael is probably correct on this. I mean, for quite a while, the labour shortage issue, I think, has been binding. And again, without sort of blinding people with numbers, I mean, very respected groups estimate that to build an extra 20,000 houses. So when you think like we're around the 30,000 mark to get up to get up to 50,000, we'd need about an extra 40,000 workers. Okay, so that's the sort of quantum you're talking about. Now, there are about 170,000 people working in the construction sector. So 40,000 is a huge number of people. Okay, so when the ESRI, we were writing about this the latter part of last year in the broader context of the National Development Plan, and we were discussing at the time this labour shortage and how it did seem to be a constraint. And at the time, we were suggesting that maybe it was time to sort of try and redirect that labour from the building of things like office blocks and hotels and other things towards the more socially required housing.
Yeah.
And at the time, we were suggesting that maybe this should be, you know, tax incentives or tax penalties or whatever way. But
it,
I think
it sounds like the market will do it now.
Well,
anyway,
this is the interesting thing. I mean, clearly, and again, just sort of casually reading the newspapers, you get a clear sense, and it's well understood that the, you know, there's probably now a glut in terms of office provision. So all those people who have been working on those for quite a long time, how seamlessly they could move, I don't really know. But that big concern about the labour force, I think, is probably
okay.
And also,
I'll come back to you, Michael. Aideen Hayden, as a housing policy expert, you picked that piece as well. What do you think of what you've heard so far?
Well, I was kind of hoping Michael might give us a few insights into the commission, but just, never mind.
We'll come to that.
we'll come to that.
Yeah, slowly catching
on
monkey.
This particular issue, you know, do we have a gap at the moment between what we will need to build and what we are actually building? There's no question of that we will, and we do. Would I be as absolutely confident as Michael Stanley? No, I wouldn't. I would say your own organisation, the SRI, produced a report in December highlighting, among other things, the lack of construction workers. And I don't think in housing things turn around that quickly. I mean, the one thing about housing...
Sure, there's a builder next to you.
I know,
yeah. Can do it.
I mean, it's a lumpy good, as they say. It takes 5 years from cup to lip to get a project over the line. Something that's in the pipeline now is very, very difficult to turn it around and say, you know what we're going to do? This was going to be an office block and now it's going to be something else. So that in itself is difficult. But I also think, you know, there are other issues we should be discussing. It shouldn't just be simply around construction workers.
And we will.
Brendan, is this. It isn't just about construction workers. It's about the type of construction workers. We need a lot more what's called, off-site construction, modern methods of construction. We need a lot more people who are skilled, for the sake of argument, in computer technology. We have 3D printers that can produce a house in 3 or 4 days, for the sake of argument. This is not a trite question. Do we at the moment have the amount of construction workers we need? I think if you asked anybody out there who was trying to get a retrofitting project off the table, they'd say absolutely no, we do not. And do we have a shortage? Yes, we do. And is there ways that we could deal with that shortage? I believe there are. And some of it may be redirecting people from office construction and other forms like hotel sector and so forth.
Okay.
But it's not going to be a quick fix.
I want to go back to Michael on that, because this is a question I kind of can't get my head around. Why are we building houses the same way we were building them 50, 100 years ago, largely?
Well, we're not. I mean, we have modern methods of construction now. It's timber framed by and large by most of the...
Timber frames happening in factories,
happening in factories and being brought to site. It's a completely different system.
And are we well scaled up for it in Ireland? Have we made the transition?
We are scaled up and scaling up more all the time in that regard.
Have you a factory somewhere?
I am connected. I'm an investor in a factory that is producing timber framed. And most contractors are house builders, developers, are investing in that. Because
how much does that speed up the building of a house?
Well, it's probably speeded up by a couple of months, but it also takes away a lot of the mystery around weather, because of how quickly you can come from have the house closed in, and that's really important. So there's no doubt we have come a long way. And we have.
Are we buying pods as well? Like, are people making pods? Pods you see about dropping in bathrooms, dropping in kitchens, all of that. Like 20, the Chinese seem to be.
20 years ago, we did pods in the UK for student accommodation. Pods are something slightly different, and I don't think are as impactful in terms of program as timber frame construction is. And that's a massive change, Brendan, to where we were in the past. But
I ask you one more question? Well, I have you on this now. Okay. Modular housing, we've been talking about for 3-4 years now, and then it never seems to kind of happen. And then turns out, is it just as nearly as expensive as building a house? Does it actually take a lot more time than we imagine? People think modular houses, knock them up and they can be done.
I think modular housing is actually misunderstood. I think people have this idea that modular housing is the be-all and end-all. The building of the house is actually the least problem we have, and I'm sure we'll come to the other issues shortly.
Yeah.
So I think this big call for modular housing on state-owned lands, like, that's a temporary modular. That probably would work in an emergency. But
I thought the modular houses now were good for 40, 50 years.
Yes, but you can build standard housing in the same period. Modular housing, a lot of modular housing is timber-framed housing, but this emergency modular became very popular when the refugee and Ukrainian situation came about. But remember, getting land zoned, getting the infrastructure in, getting planning, they're all my big items that are holding up the delivery of housing. The actual construction piece is not as significant as people think it is. And it's misunderstood. And that's something that, to answer your question, you think why isn't this happening more? It won't make any material difference to the numbers of houses being built. Trust me.
What won't?
Having modular housing
only. Okay.
Can I ask Michael a question?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering where you, this all started with the piece in the front of the Business Post that we could need up to, isn't it, 80,000 a year in certain circumstances. Michael says the builders are there. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, if they're, you know, if they're there, why aren't there more building? Or this will be complicated, even though Michael makes it sound simple, and all of that. We're going, it seems to go around in the usual circles, in that it's a different story depending on who you talk to. But are you basically saying there, to bring it around, you're saying yes now because there isn't so much demand for office blocks, you have the people there who can build, but that it's basically the planning and the infrastructure, so it doesn't matter that the labour force is available? Is that what you're saying?
Well, first of all, I'm saying it in a defensive way, because a lot of the political noise is that we don't have the capacity to build the extra houses. Right. I don't accept that. So to go back to your point in relation to, if we are dealing with the numbers that are required, and I'm not, repeat, not here speaking on behalf of the Irish Housing Commission, I'm here speaking as an individual, and I've had these views long held, we should be building at least 50,000, as the Taoiseach said, and probably 60,000 plus houses a year. I'm saying to you, Alison, if we had faced up to the right targets a long time ago. I mean, back in 2016, there was a census.
Okay, look. I remember after the crash, we had too many houses for the next 100 years. We're never going to build it. So look, let's leave that where it is. I think there are more useful things we could talk about now.
Okay.
So look, I don't want to focus on Michael too much. I want to ask you one more thing. So you're in the Sunday Times as well today. Flynn seeks LDA help to build 500 apartments. Linda Daly is writing. And so is the model now, I'm not going to ask you to give me the details on that because it doesn't seem like it's a done deal. Is the model now that basically building is going to become a semi-state kind of industry? Are it's ye and the government working together?
Well, that's good.
Where this is
that's
at?
That's a good
yeah?
question. And I've been saying for a long time, as have others, if we're going to produce the numbers that are needed for the varied tenures of requirement in this country, there has to be collaboration between the private and public sector.
For money, you need money from the public sector, and for capacity
to deliver. I mean, some people are calling out politically, oh, we should have a state construction company, we should do this, we should do that. Let's deal with what's possible. And what's likely to happen. And that article that you referred to in the Sunday Times today, we're just one of many talking to the LDA who are out there discussing panel-type structures with house builders.
What type structures?
Panel, creating panels to work with builders so that they can quickly get onto site, get away from some of the public procurement challenges, which haven't served us really well in this country, because there's a lot of difficulties around that.
Okay, so explain that in English. So there won't be a full long-winded procurement. There'll be a panel of builders there who work with the government, and there'll be a kind of a faster process for the government to say, okay, you do this project with us.
We and others will hopefully be part of panels that the LDA will work with. And in working with that, you're not on the old procurement system where the costs are unknown. This is you're working in collaboration with the LDA.
So the LDA is taking some of the risk as well as you, is that
well,
it?
It's very clear. The LDA are well researched in terms of the model they want to use, and the risk will pass over. But the important point here, the risk will be with the deliverer, being the house builder contractor. It won't be with the LDA. It won't be an open check. And this is really important, because if we want to deliver housing at scale, whether it is social, cost rental or whatever, we have to do it in conjunction with the private sector. You might say, I would say that, wouldn't I? But there is no other alternative.
Aideen, is he right? Is this the model?
Well,
going
I think people don't realise the extent to which the state is currently supporting the construction sector. Since our external investment parties that had come into this country to build built-to-rent housing disappeared, a bit like the snow in front of the sun, when the interest rate environment changed and it was no longer profitable.
Which we didn't want them here anyway.
They literally departed overnight, and the state has taken up a lot of the slack in that, in taking over these developments and producing them for social housing. So the reality of the matter is that is one area in where the state is carrying the can for the construction sector. There are parts of the country that if it weren't, if the state weren't building social housing in parts of this country, particularly in urban, suburban areas outside of the main urban centres, there'd be no construction happening at all.
So in terms of houses for a young couple starting out, first-time buyers and everything, is there nothing much happening?
There are
space?
Counties in this country where there is no development happening whatsoever. Literally none. That has not been actually generated by the state. I'm not talking about once-off housing. That's a different issue completely. It is still...
So that's a highly unbalanced model.
Very much
it?
So. Very much so.
In a country that has an aspiration to home ownership.
Absolutely.
And a generation.
It is not healthy for the country at all. You have areas of the country. I mean, we used to talk about the rental crisis as Dublin, Cork, Galway, Limerick, you know, etc. There's a rental crisis in every single county in this country.
And why is
now.
It not happening that there's no private development
because
going on there?
Because it is more expensive to build. It is more expensive to build than it is to buy secondhand houses for starters, and certainly in counties like, say, Sligo, Leitrim, Westmeath, and so on, the difference is enormous, like 200,000 potentially.
So even though, and we come back to this every now and again, even though house prices are so high and inaccessible to so many people of the younger generation, they're still not profitable to build.
Particularly outside of the major urban areas.
And Michael, even if, like the, was it the Croí Cónaithe City scheme offered 150 grand to developers? So you get 150 grand literally into your arse pocket to build an apartment. So you could build an apartment that could cost you 500 grand to build. You could sell it for 400 and still be making a profit. And even at that, it's not worth building those apartments.
The reality is, we still couldn't make a profit even with that subsidy. There are very few Croí Cónaithe schemes that have actually happened in this country. And Aideen is right about the lack of private house building. But people don't understand the costs that are involved and also some of the issues.
But then, like, we look at Cairn and Glenveagh today, like, their profits are in the papers again. Like, their profits going up this year. They're predicting more profits in 2024.
Yep.
In and around
Brendan,
100 million or more made last year.
But you need to distinguish between Glenveagh and Cairns and the rest of the construction sector. Look, so for example, Dermot O'Leary from Goodbody Stockbrokers, he did some research, and you know, Glenveagh and Cairns are producing 12% of the entire stock of homes in the country. But over and above that, 473 builders are only producing an average of 34 units a year. So you have a certain number of builders who've got scale. And over and above that, you have a huge number of builders who don't have scale.
Particularly,
Michael, I'm sure you'd agree, when it comes to the requirement to build apartment developments, that is a huge, you know, it's a huge, for a small developer to build an apartment development, for example, where they don't get paid until the last unit is built, there's a huge upfront cost. And, you know, as the SRI identified, capital funding for that type of development is very, very difficult and a big impediment for the development of housing in Ireland.
Alison, so you're listening to all this. Are you hopeful? Like, I think that was quite clear, a lot of what
very
what
and very, very, very depressing, wasn't it? Particularly if you're a young person and looking to buy a house. I suppose I'm also struck by just this sense of you're trying to work out what to believe, you know, where everyone is coming from, that even, you know, with that still I think developers have an issue from the crash with there being a credibility issue in terms of a government deciding to do more for them and people believing that that's, I mean, you can see that it's the big guns that you called out there that are making the money and not, as Aideen said, the smaller companies. But I'm thinking about it politically, I suppose. I'm thinking that with a general election coming up very, very fast, and in terms of the two sides, and by that I mean the government parties and the Sinn Féin side, who have been hammer and tongs on housing. I know it's fallen off the agenda a little bit over the last few weeks in favour of immigration.
Opinion polls, though,
it's still,
housing
no,
is still
it
number
is.
One
but,
for
Brendan,
people, yeah.
Interestingly, on the doorsteps for the elections, There is an awful lot of talk coming back that it's immigration,
yeah,
and that there isn't as much talk on housing at all, which I think is very interesting.
And we'll come to
and
the
that
immigration.
And I mean,
after
I suppose I'd say it just shows to me that communicating on that and the government trying to have credibility on that is as sort of, despite the fact that we see there are lots of new developments, you see the cranes, all of that in certain places, that the government has as much of an uphill battle on that as it did even, I don't know, 3 years ago, I think.
Does it, Michael, just before we go, are we any closer to solving the housing crisis? And like, if there was one thing that could happen to help?
The immediate answer is no. I know we're waiting for an NPF review, the National Planning Framework review, but we know from the census figures, which I know you don't want me to go into, but there was a prediction of a million extra requirements back 6 years ago. Guess what? We've reached 600,000 of that up to 2040. In 6 years, we've actually hit 600,000, being 500,000 the change of the population,
okay,
and
so
100,000 visitors.
So we take the target now is 50, which you say 50 or 60, and
yes,
you say it can be done and everything. So what needs to happen to bring us closer to solving this?
Well, first of all, you need to zone enough land and have an infrastructure policy to service that land. We haven't done that in the past. We haven't enough zoned land. And it's kind of unpopular to say that, but our land is one of our core raw material. It has fallen in cost. But if we don't have enough zoned land, like we had a system in this country, and this was all under the National Planning Framework, we had a brownfield development. You mentioned it yourself about the subsidies. You can't understand why it still doesn't work. If we have a reliance on brownfield development, we have a shortage of greenfield development. We have a shortage of land that's zoned. And zoning and infrastructure are huge problems, which people seem to want to think, no, they're not. Yes, they are.
Okay.
Also, planning remains a problem. And funding, which has been mentioned already, funding is a major problem. It's okay to talk about the PLCs because they're publicly funded structures and the banks are doing their bit and other state-connected situations are. But if we were to be building what's needed to be built in this country, I can tell you we have a development funding shortfall because, fine, the institutional investors, and they got called all kinds of names, were crucial in delivering investment. But if you're getting into development, that's a completely different type of investor. And we need outside money if we are to fund the development, not what we are doing, what we should be doing.
OK, so bring back the cuckoo. We saw a cuckoo coming back. We've done how many thousand kilometres this week. So, yeah, bring back the cuckoos maybe is the answer, I think. OK, we'll take a break. Alison O'Connor, Aideen Hayden, Michael O'Flynn and Alan Barrett staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Alison O'Connor, Aideen Hayden, Michael O'Flynn and Professor Alan Barrett are still with us. Alan Barrett, you're looking at the Mail on Sunday today. There are two types of people in the world, the people who are going to inherit and the people who aren't. And it informs their views on a lot of things, I think. So the story today is that the Fine Gael are hoping to leave legacy for our Sinn Féin friends, quote, by doubling threshold for inheritance tax to 700,000.
Yeah, as soon as I saw the headline, I kind of zoned in on this story. Inheritance taxes are probably amongst the most fascinating taxes that we can discuss. And they really challenge even the most liberal of people.
Okay.
So if you're in a room and you say to people, do you believe in equality of opportunity? Do you think everybody, you know, should start with the same chances? All the hands always shoot up, okay, because who could possibly be against that? But then when you say, well, do you think you should be able to pass over as much cash as you want to your kids? You know, again, people are start getting because they can see where this is going. So it really, really challenges people that, you know, they might talk about equality, but they feel they should be able to pass over fund. So at the moment in Ireland, a child can inherit 350,000. And then you pay inheritance tax over that. It's, I think, about a third of the balance. This comes up periodically and it's normally put in the context of house price inflation. OK, so the idea is for most people, what you inherit is like a family house. And clearly then there's a sort of an emotive thing then about families and handing things over. But the bigger picture is always around this idea. Do we as a society think it is fair that one generation passes on
an awful lot of it.
I'm going to admit I'm quite challenged about it. Now, I'll take the sort of soft option and I say, oh yeah, equality means so much to me. The other thing I should say, though, is that remember, the 350,000 is per child. OK, so very, very often it does mean that people can actually bequeath, you know, if they have a number of kids.
Smaller families.
But it is very, very challenging. Last thing I'll say on it, actually, though, somebody might correct me if I get this wrong, but a number of years ago, when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, OK, and soon after he'd become Prime Minister, he was looking to hold an election. But he backed off. And I think inheritance taxes might have been one of the reasons that he backed off on this, because it does really sort of challenge people. It's an issue that people don't talk about.
We'll be talking later,
no doubt, about how do people rank the sort of issues, so people will talk about housing and migration. Nobody's going to say inheritance taxes.
Yeah.
But in the quietness of the ballot box, I think this matters a lot.
And Alison, there's a fascinating aspect to it, too, of leaving a legacy for a Sinn Féin friends. Because is there a feeling among the backbenchers in Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, that why are we saving up all this money if we're going to be handing it over to the Shinners, who will, like Michael D, go mad if they get into government?
I'm just thinking first what fun Alan would be at a dinner party with his button pushing questions and inheritance tax. Yeah, there is an element of that. I mean, there's been an element of that for a long time in terms of how good the nation's finances are, how healthy the national coffers are, you know, and the idea that this will be handed over. I mean, this story by John Drennan, as he's saying that this is like how the two, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have been trying to outdo each other with their public promises ahead of the election and ahead of the budget in October. And it's Colm Brophy that's been quoted, the Fine Gael TD, and he's describing it as, again, emotive language, the penal tax on home and hearth, and that it's a taxation taxation priority. And certainly, I remember in the past seeing posters, I'm trying to remember, around Dublin South about this is during previous elections on this very issue. So I think it's more of the sort of firing arrows or whatever across the bows of each other in terms of it. Also, I think gets to the heart of the closeness of the election, how we're going to see now the three parties who've held together pretty well up to this, vying with each other.
It's got very scrappy now.
It's got very scrappy.
Are relationships deteriorating as well?
Have to bear in mind that they're also trying to build. There's a new Taoiseach only a month in, and it's trying to build that relationship. And I know that even in terms of with the Greens there's kind of cranky feeling towards the Greens on the part of the other two parties in terms of like the bad feeling from farmers and that, and this sort of sense of the Greens better not be looking for anything more than what they're entitled to. So it's as time passes, that is only going to get worse. I think we're going to see more of it during the summer. Traditionally, it gets much quieter in the summer, but I think with the fact that we are going to have an election, it's going to be a scrappy summer.
When are you currently calling an election?
I would be inclined to think November. I'm inclined to think that the budget, I think it's their best shot, and as I said earlier, there will still be a significant amount of money to go around. You can disagree on whether that's what should happen or not, or what we should do with that. But I think in terms of the government parties wanting to do well and win as many seats as possible, that's what makes the most sense to me.
Okay. Can I just look at another tax issue that I thought was
quickly?
Going to
come up? Yeah.
There's an arrangement in place at the moment. You get tax breaks on your pension contributions up to a ceiling that your pension fund is worth 2 million. Okay, now this is one of these possible tax changes that will only affect a small group of people, but it could be very, very political too. There is a group sitting at the moment to decide whether or not that 2 million threshold should be increased. OK, so it may not affect a huge number of people, but
it seems to affect senior guards.
Well, certainly senior civil servants.
Politicians, probably. Yeah. So it's a public sector thing.
It is, but it's still a small enough group of people that will be there. But again, one for the tax nerds and social justice people.
As soon as you say 2 million, everyone's just thinking, that's plenty. Like, but somehow if you reach the second echelon of the Gardaí, you have to retire at a particular point in order to not tip over the 2 million, it would seem.
Yep.
Yeah. Aideen, the broader political discussion is still around migration, though. You picked Shane Coleman in the Business Post. Irish politics shifting to the right as migration dominates debate. Is it?
Yeah, I think there's been a significant change in the discourse over the last month in particular. Housing was very much, you know, up front and central, you know, and certainly any of the vox pops that were done with people who were on the doorsteps were saying, you know, housing, housing and more housing. But, you know, there has been a change of mood, I think, in the last number of weeks. And people are very concerned about I think what people are seeing is an influx of migration that is, you know, over and above what the country can handle. And what we're seeing in the media, obviously, you know, doesn't give a lie to that. I mean, the Taoiseach himself says, oh, you know, we weren't expecting this level of influx. This is more than we can handle. You know, it's constantly, oh, we're changing tack now. And we're putting, like things like we're putting together, a group of agencies to come together now to start looking at this. And you're sort of thinking to yourself, well, you know, this has been an issue since 2014. How on God's earth are we now suddenly realising that it's going to become an issue for Ireland? I do find it somewhat annoying in a way that while all of this was going on in Southern Europe, for the sake of argument, and it was Greece or Italy or countries on the border of Eastern Europe, when all of that was happening, we were benignly sitting here asking questions like, we offered 4,000 places to Syrians back in 2016 and they didn't come. Does nobody love us? And now, like 8 years later, here we are going, what's happened? How come they're all here?
We're too generous. Michael, yeah.
No, but just to say one thing though, Brandon, we have to accept we are actually one of the richest countries in Europe. And for a lot of immigrants, a lot of them, their second language would be English. And therefore, it's an easier country for some of them to adapt into than maybe other European countries would be.
Also, Aideen, I don't think that we're taking like a disproportionate amount compared to the size
of
our population.
If you compare our population to the number of migrants we've taken in, it is roughly proportionate to what we are taking in. We are not being overwhelmed, and we haven't even started to look at the benefits of the impact these migrants could have on what's already an economy in full employment that could actually benefit from some immigration.
Michael, you picked Simon Harris has an opinion piece in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah.
Could you would you have any response to the tent situation and the accommodation
I think the Simon Harris out the Taoiseach's piece today in the Sunday Independent is quite interesting, and I think Aideen hit the nail on the head there when she talked about we didn't plan or we didn't react. I know we're kind of running when it's late. I think his piece is the not my problem attitude. I could apply that to a lot of the issues around housing as well. I think we can't lose sight of the fact that we have signed up to a European migration pact. We have to take so many. And as you said yourself there a moment ago, we're not that disproportionate. But we have no structure. We've no plan to actually do what we should be doing.
What would you do? Well, accommodation-wise?
In relation to the tents, just to answer that question you asked me, I think the tent situation is absolutely appalling. But it's illegal to have tents where we have them. And what I don't understand is that you have structures being funded by government giving out the tents, and then you have them being erected where they're illegal. I mean, that's an extraordinary situation. And I think the Taoiseach's points here are quite relevant. But why are we getting to this point? Like, we need to have a plan if we're taking on outside people. We didn't have a plan. To answer your question, I would say that if people have to get tents, they need to be put into empty buildings where there's sanitation and where there's some sort of structure. And we have
tents
lots
in empty buildings.
Tents in empty buildings is better than tents along by the canal. I'm saying if we have that emergency position and we haven't planned, and let's be blunt here, we haven't planned. we have not planned for this. And now I'm saying tents in an empty building are far better than tents by the side of the street. And it's illegal to have tents. And we shouldn't be afraid to stop that and do something about it. But I think the position is these people have a contribution to make. Just don't forget the migration situation. They have a contribution to make. We mentioned about workers. We need people in this country. And I think it's mentioned in that article that there's over 20,000 people in the healthcare sector. I mean, 20,000 people in the healthcare sector are an awful lot of people that are vital to the healthcare sector at this time. So we can't lose sight of the benefits.
We read today that over half the nurses in the country now are non-nationals. Yes, the mail. Would not
go to a hospital.
Alison, I don't think that Michael meant that Simon Harris was writing Not My Problem today. I think you were kind of being very complimentary about the piece.
Yes.
There. He is very speaking very clearly and saying we are now galvanising here. The pass the parcel between departments is over, he is saying.
Well, yeah, that's the point I was making. I was making a different point. Yeah.
I find this very interesting politically, right?
Okay.
If you look at the language, some of the phrasing, this is the way we will move forward. I am not standing for any more unnecessary delays. This will not be a long drawn out process. It will be a system that is firm, fair and enforced. That's the new word added to the firm and fair we've been hearing over the last few weeks. So this is the Taoiseach sort of saying he's tying his wagon now to the fact that he is going to change this, that he is going to change the system. We heard Michael talking about at various times about inertia in the system. And I mean, we know so much about the system looking for, be it for housing or for housing asylum seekers, looking for all these state agencies to do an audit and come back, which always takes years and hasn't happened. Simon Harris is now saying, I'm going to change that. So that's quite high political stakes. Now, I think that what we saw this week, though, basically, that's fine on one hand, is the government creating a sort of a whole new way now of if you want to get better housing as an immigrant, and why wouldn't you, basically set up a tent along the canal and they'll, one morning everyone will be swept off and brought somewhere to another tent, it has to be said. And even that's interesting in itself because that's military tents and there's actually a shortage of those across Europe because that's what a lot of EU countries are doing. What we're going to see in the medium term is we'll say places like Thornton Hall, which was mentioned various times as a prison site, these military tents, if they can get them on a much larger scale, we're going to see, and this is mentioned in a couple of articles this morning, an entire review, I think, of the allowances that are available so that we don't have what is known as this pull factor. And I suppose it's the government is just completely on the back foot here. People are feeling, I was writing about this myself today in my column of the Sunday Times. I was quoting that Father Ted episode there, you know, are we all racist now, Father? Where you're kind of, it's difficult to know what to think and how to gauge it, because I think people are seeing the headlines, they're seeing the stuff on social media and they're panicking. It's a fear of the unknown. It's a fear of inundation. And it's not right. And we know, we see, and I think Aideen mentioned how much value there can be from immigrants in the health system or wherever, how much they can add to our society. But people aren't getting that message from our politicians. I heard Pascal Donoghue on Morning Ireland on Friday, and it was one of the few over the last few weeks where he spoke very positively about it. And this is a man whose constituency of Dublin Central has a high percentage of immigrants, and it may not, you know, you could say that the stakes are high for him, but we don't see enough of that. And yet it's complicated. Even one figure I heard that we'll say 2,000 Ukrainians have moved out of state accommodation, you know, hotels, places like that, since they cut the allowances there. But IPAS, international protection applicants, have not moved into those places because a lot of those people who own those hotels or whatever are refusing to take IPAS people because they're saying it's not worth the hassle. We've all seen the violence on videos and that, even against builders. So it's not easy, and I don't know how it's going to be. There's a headline, there's a piece in the, I'll finish on this, in the Observer today, talking about Keir Starmer. And Keir Starmer is saying that if he's elected, he will drop the Rwanda policy. In Irish government circles, they're hoping that will improve things here. Who knows whether it will or not. But the opening piece is that the line is talk about Keir Starmer making immigration boring again. And I think our government could only hope and pray to find themselves in that sort of a scenario. They're nowhere near that.
Alan.
I'm going to make three rapid fire points,
yeah,
if I may, because things are moving quickly today. The first is this issue that, you know, the electorate is now consumed by immigration. I find this really, really strange. OK, I can understand it. Like so
can
many
we
people
open the
use
doorsteps.
No, but what I don't understand is like if, the, you know, a lot of people use the health system on a daily, weekly, yearly basis. If the health system is bad, I can understand people are upset by it. You know, taxation, everybody's affected by it. The cost of it affected everybody. Like the reality is how many people on a daily basis are affected by the immigration crisis? The answer is very, very few. And if anything, the vast majority of people in this country benefit enormously from inward migration because of all the work that it might
do. So a narrative.
So I find it very, very strange.
Okay.
The second thing is I know we love in Ireland always to blame somebody. Now we're blaming the government. The reality is the migration issue has accelerated to such a degree that it is very, very difficult to deal with it. Okay, any system, you know, that gets swamped in the way that it has, it wasn't anybody's in Ireland's fault. There's way more immigrants coming into Europe generally, so this was always going to be a challenge. And the last thing I'll say is, right, a fascinating research paper during the week, which talked about, like, you know, why do asylum seekers go to certain countries? It has almost nothing to do with the generosity of welfare systems and housing and all those sort of things. The two main drivers are firstly network effects. People are much more likely to go where other people have gone. And the other thing is the speed of the decision-making process and the probability of success. So tinkering with all these sort of social is not actually
OK, but they are speeding up the decision-making process, as we keep being told. OK, Alison O'Connor, Aideen Hayden, Michael O'Flynn and Alan Bard staying with us. We'll take another quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
OK, welcome back. Alison O'Connor, Aideen Hayden, Michael O'Flynn and Professor Alan Barrett are still with us and we have about 4 minutes. And Alison, I'm going to give half of it to you to tell us about RTE. The Mail are not, like a lot of people kind of moved on during the week from the RTE reports. The Mail are sticking with it and you picked a few pieces from there.
Yeah, they have it as their lead story. And also inside, the John Lee and Ron Drennan have this a piece about this issue that we still don't know what's the funding for the future, where Media Minister Catherine Martin came out this week again and said that she is in favour of state funding. And this piece is basically saying that's the headline is that's a no, Catherine, that's not going to happen. And
is there
that's
a big row building up here?
I wouldn't be surprised, because if she was very, you know, resolute on it, the minister was, when she said it this week. And yet Micheál Martin has made clear where he stands on it. Michael McGrath, even Pascal Donoghue, I think, said also the fact that there's already a revenue stream there, why get rid of it? And the part that bothers me, which has also been mentioned, this idea that RTE would be dependent on the government, and that's a very dangerous situation on a yearly basis for media freedom. Catherine Martin did say, I heard her during the week say that, we'll say, for instance, TG Carr, that's how they're funded. Now, with all due respect to TG Carr, which I think is a very fine channel, does fantastic work, it is not in the same eye of the storm as RTE would be politically and as acutely and under that sort of pressure. So I think that this is looking like it's brewing up to be a row, and Catherine Martin has put herself very much on one particular side of it and will very much need the backing of her party leader, Eamon Ryan, and it'll be interesting to see what happens, especially when we've been told this is going to be sorted out, a decision is going to be made by the summer.
Will it be?
I kind of think they've put an awful lot of political capital into saying that. I know, but into saying that,
I think
no more than the rest of us, they're sick of it too, you know?
Okay. And then I suppose a kind of a related schmozzle there, Michael O'Flynn, you had to go to Páirc Uí last night. You wouldn't shell out for GAA go to watch the Cork match.
No, I was very happy to be there. It was a great Cork night, as you'd appreciate, Brendan. Being from Cork, it was a fantastic result. But GAA Go has been in the news, and it's covered today by Michael Foley in the Times and Shane McGrath in the Mail in relation to this whole scenario that has evolved.
Shane McGrath makes an interesting point here. Can I just read out a line from him?
Yes.
And then GAA Go is an easy target, but the truth is there's a constituency in hurling that wouldn't be happy unless every match in the competition was put on air with a vote of candle flickering beneath the TV set.
Yeah, and that's a fair comment, and I read the article. But the blunt reality of it is we have to accept we can't have all matches on TV. That's the first point. The second point is we have to have all important matches on TV. And I think and the government are slightly involved in this because they have certain direction given. But this is much an RTE thing as it is a GAA situation. It's sort of being pointed at the GAA as this money-making.
But are there too many matches happening in too condensed a period of time?
Well,
all the matches people want can't be on TV.
I accept that. And having GAA go means you've more matches covered that can be watched by people in wherever they're located, which is a big benefit. But you can't prescribe matches at the outset of the year and then miss crucial matches. Like there was 40-something thousand people in Páirc Uí Chaoimh last night. It was phenomenal, the atmosphere there. But that's not captured for a lot of people unless there's TV coverage. I mean, I've watched GAA go at times. Depends on where you're located. Depends on your Wi-Fi. It depends on all sorts of situations.
So what I'm saying is common sense
needs to apply here. You can have a structure which deals all important games, and I'm more of a hurling person, fine, but football has to be covered almost equally. You have a lot of interest in hurling, but crucial football matches and crucial hurling matches need to be covered. And what you need to do is have a flexible system that this important game that was on last night, because it was a knockout game for Cork, is covered as are other games. And the great plus about GAA Go is that you can have a lot more games covered, but you can prescribe them at the outset and then stick to them, because you could have a game, if Cork were beaten last night, there'd be a TV coverage of the next game that nobody would have interest in. So you've got to be sensible and bring some common sense.
Common sense, the man says. Common sense.
It's not that common at times.
Yeah, okay. Alison O'Connor, Aideen Hayden, Michael O'Flynn and Professor Alan Barrett, thank you very much for that very illuminating, entertaining hour.